is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
It was really great for me, because I will say this for Mark, he really helped me in my career, because I was an assistant for him with him for a long time, is that every year he kind of gave me more and more responsibility, and to the point where there were things that I just did that were mine. And that was great for me, because, you know, Pat Riley always says, don't underestimate your time in the trenches. And as an assistant, that's the best time in the world. None of these wins and losses go on your record. You know, you just work, and you get to see things that you like and don't like, and you can keep track of them in your head and journal them. And so when I become a head coach, and so it was great for me to see all that and put it all together.
John Baines is entering his seventh season as the head men's basketball coach at Elmhurst College. Baines has an 89-69 record in six seasons as the Blue Jays head coach. A longtime assistant for the Blue Jays, Baines became the 15th men's head basketball coach in Elmhurst history when Mark Scherer announced his retirement from coaching following the 2012-2013 season. Baines began his collegiate coaching career at Elmhurst in 2000-2001. He spent 10 seasons as Scherer's right-hand man in Elmhurst before becoming the head coach at the University of St. Francis in 2010. In nine seasons as a head coach, Baines has compiled a 146-107 overall record. John began his coaching career at Bloomington High School in 1998 before joining Scherer's coaching staff at Elmhurst. Baines played his college basketball at Illinois Wesleyan University. He was part of teams that compiled a 103-14 record, played in the NCAA tournament four times, reached the Final Four twice, and won a national championship in 1997. If you enjoy this episode, please leave us a 5-star rating and review on iTunes or wherever you listen to the show. Make sure you're subscribed to the Hoopheads Pod so you don't miss an episode, and tell a friend or colleague in the basketball community to give us a listen. Be prepared to take some notes as you listen to this episode with John Baines, the men's head coach at Elmhurst College in Illinois.
Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads Podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here with my co-host Jason Sunkel. And tonight we are pleased to welcome John Baines, the head coach at Elmhurst College in the state of Illinois. John, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Mike. I really appreciate it.
We're very excited to have you on, get a chance to talk to you about all the great things you've been able to do in coaching up to this point and how you've been able to have sustained success there at Elmhurst. I want to start, though, by going back to your days as a young kid and talk to us a little bit about how you discovered and fell in love with the game of basketball when you were younger.
Well, to be honest with you, I don't think either one of my parents thought I was going to be any good at basketball. I was, I'm 6'7". I was totally uncoordinated. And this is a true story. My very first pair of basketball shoes cost $5, and my mom bought them at Kroger in a little tiny bin because she didn't think I was going to be any good. So she didn't want to waste any money on shoes.
All right, stop. But, so I gotta ask you. So that jogs my memory of a story. My first pair of basketball shoes were bought out of a bin from Fisher's Big Wheel. I don't know if they had that store by where you were, but Fisher's Big Wheel is like a, you know, again, a
right,
whatever, you know, a big box, kind of the old fashioned Target, Walmart type store,
right,
Kmart,
right,
whatever. And me and my dad was playing in like a, I don't know, an early morning, like men's pickup basketball game. And I was tagging along. This is probably when I was in maybe fourth grade, and the shoes were at the end of the aisle in the bin, and mine were called Super BBs. That was the brand, Super BBs. So I will never forget that my first pair of basketball shoes were out of a bin. I've never met anybody else whose first basketball pair of shoes was out of a bin. So we got something going here, John.
At least you had a name on your shoes. Mine were just blank white with nothing on them. And
well, there you go. Hey,
they were just blank Kroger shoes. I don't know what you call them, No, that's how I started out, you know, and I was a tall, gangly guy that was uncoordinated, and luckily I was tall, because I think I probably would have been cut but I wasn't, and had the glasses and the braces and everything. And so, but when I got into high school, I got an unbelievable coach. I had a really good junior high coach, and then I had a Hall of Fame high school coach, and ended up having a Hall of Fame college coach. And so that's how I got started at the high school level and the junior high. And I just kind of, I grew into my body, and then became a pretty decent player.
Even though you maybe were a little gangly and that kind of thing, when you when you got started, did you immediately know that you liked it despite the fact that maybe you didn't have a tremendous amount of initial success? Or was it the fact that you were tall and people just kept kind of putting the game in front of you, and eventually you decided, hey, this is something that I really want to pursue? Or was it something that, hey, even though I'm not very good at it right now, there's something about this that I love? Which one was more descriptive of you?
I loved it. I love playing. You know, I played for, you know, I played a different time. I'm 43, but we didn't have a lifting program. There wasn't any individual workouts. We just played a lot. I mean, we played 5 or 6 days a week, and we'd play at 7 a.m. in PE. And I just love the game. And, you know, it's funny you ask that question. To digress a little bit, I asked that question to some coaches as I'm, you know, sitting through live periods and watching AU and watching high school games. And I said, you know, I wonder what the percentage of guys is out here that are just really enjoying playing summer ball. They just like playing it, you know. And I remember when I was in team camp in high school, you know, we'd go to Illinois State team camp, and that was like the highlight of my summer. I loved it. I love playing against new guys. And it wasn't like I was trying to get exposure or trying to get somebody to look at me or rank me. I just liked lacing them up and playing. And so, yeah, that was me. And I think at my level, that's kind of the type of player I'm trying to look for when I go. It's not, they're like only guys that just want to play and be in the gym, that sort of guy.
Yeah. I think that's something that it's not always the case anymore. I think social media has changed that to some degree. I think that there's also a degree of change in the way that we all parent. Mm-hmm. We just talked to Larry Hughes a little bit right before we talked to you, and Larry was describing how when he was a kid, you know, he would just head up to the playground, and you know, his mom might have kind of knew where he was, but for the most part, right, he was on his own. And I was the same way when I was a kid. I would just go, and I'd go to the local park, or as I got older, I'd hop in a friend's car and we'd go and drive around the city to try to find the best games. And my mom and dad had no idea where I was specifically, and they might have generally known where I was, but for the most part, they didn't have the tabs on me that we have today as parents. And I think that's one of the things that when you look at how basketball has changed, I think kids today miss out on that playground basketball atmosphere where you just go and you play for 3-4 hours and maybe you lose and you got to sit for 2-3-4 games, right, and that, right, kind of thing. And it's just basketball is much different than it was in the era when you or I were growing up, where there was less organized basketball and more just playing with your friends or finding a pickup game. And, you know, we've talked to a lot of coaches about there's pros and cons, obviously, to both systems. And I think as I'm going to use the term old guys, at least to refer to myself, I think we tend to feel that, you know, whatever system that you came up in, I think you tend to have some nostalgia for that and feel like it's the right system. But I think there's a lot of great things about the system that we have today. I think kids get exposed to better coaching earlier in their playing career. I think that one of the things we've talked to some other coaches about is just the fact that I think there's far more skilled kids at all levels of basketball. And if you look at the back end of a high school roster, those kids who are players 9, 10, 11, 12 are far more skilled than they used to be. Back in the day. And I think that's got to make your job as a college coach trying to figure out who can I recruit, who can I play. It seems like there's this big giant group in the middle. Obviously the kids who are the most talented still stand out just the way they did 15 years ago, 30 years ago, whatever. But I think there's a much bigger group in the middle that you're like, man, having to, you know, slice and dice and figure out what's the difference between the kid over here and the kid over here. Because so many of them are so much more skilled than kids used to be in the past. Do you see that as a college coach when you're out on the recruiting trail?
I do. And you know, that was the kind of to take that question or that thought. You know, you see a lot more a gap defense, pack line D, you know, than you ever did. You know, I think it used to be, you know, so much high pressure up and on the line and guard your guy. And I think really a lot of the reason that is that phenomenon has kind of come along where people are playing in the gaps, even at the NBA level, is it's hard to guard a guy one-on-one now. You know, I think that 20, 30 years ago, there was some good skilled players, but there weren't the one-on-one, the guys that could get by a guy by themselves. And I think to ask a kid now to just say, hey, go guard that guy, is really hard for them. And so they need a lot more team defense and in that realm. And so I see that as a skill. I think the individual skills are and athleticism are better. I think maybe the ability to play in a team structure has been kind of hurt. I think that's suffered. But I think the individual skills of them have definitely gone up. And like you said, with finding guys at college, you know, it goes like you said with the social media. There's no more sleepers anymore. You know, that guy that would play at the little tiny town that nobody knows about, you know, that kid now is seen and is on Twitter and everybody kind of knows about him. And so, yeah, you have to decipher. There's not going to be like I have a guy and he's going to, you know, under a rock and no one's going to find him. They'll find him. You just have to decipher which ones are really going to make it. And that can be difficult.
Yeah, I'm sure it is. I think for you, it comes back down to if you can find out and figure out who loves to play. I think that's it's obviously a difficult thing to discern in some cases. But if you can discern that, I think that does act as a separator. If I think about players that I've been around as a coach and I think about players that I was around as a player, there's no question that the people who attained the most level of success or the people who got closest to their potential were the people who loved to play, who didn't require a coach to tell them, hey, you should go work on your game, or hey, you should take care of your body, or hey, you should eat properly. The guys that love the game are the ones that do all those things without somebody having to ask them. And that's not to say that they don't take coaching and they don't need to be pushed by a coach. But if you love the game, it becomes much easier to coach a player like that without question.
Right. And I tell you, it's funny because you were talking about like old heads and new heads. Whenever I played and when I was in high school, we had like three or four gyms that we got kicked out of. And like you go play and then you get kicked out of that one and then you drive down and then you crawl in the window of the next place until somebody kicked you out. And then you'd end up back at the gym you started at 2 hours later type of thing. And I think that for me, I laugh now because I've got some guys that really work on their game on their own. And that you have to have that at this level. And I get a lot of calls from security saying, hey, John, are some of your guys in the gym right now or can they stay in? And that always kind of gives me that little nice smile to my face, you know, like, yeah, you know, you don't kick them out, that, you know, let them stay in there type of thing. That always brings a nice smile.
Yeah, no question about that. I think that's really a positive when your kids are wanting to put in extra time. And as a coach, I think there's nothing more gratifying than being able to see your kids wanting to get better, again, outside the confines of what they do as a team. And obviously, you as a Division III coach have limited contact that you're able to have in the off season with your guys. So that makes it even more important, that, quote, love for the game. If they're going to be working on it in the off season, they're going to be doing that on their own, maybe with some guidance from you in terms of what they should be working on or what they can take away from you in the off season. But you and your staff can't be there physically working with them. So that gives them an opportunity, if they want to put in the time, that they're able to do that. I'm sure those are the kind of players that you're really looking for out there.
Yeah. Is that, I mean, that's a question that comes up in recruiting that sometimes offends players, and it's not meant to be offensive, but you know, a lot of times they'll sit in my office and they'll say, you know, coach, I'm working on this. And I say, how often are you working on it? Or I'll give them the, do you really like being in the gym? You know, it's going to be 80 degrees and sunny out here soon. Do you like being in there? And they, you know, sometimes that takes them aback, but I also think that whenever they take it the right way, and that's the type of kid that does do that stuff, then you know that question really reveals a lot to whether they really want to be in there or not.
Yeah, I would think that you'd get some pretty good answers there from kids who, you know, who may or may not, depending on where they are in their development and their thought process, you know, maybe they do love the game, but maybe they don't. I know that, you know, when I played in college, there were guys that I played with that loved the game and wanted to work on it. And there were other guys that the season would end and they'd put the ball away for a long time. And, right. you know, that was at the Division I level. And so I can imagine that no matter what level of basketball you are and what type of team you play on, there's always guys that love it more than others and that want to put in more time. And I think you could take it from the lowest level of youth leagues all the way up to the NBA. I'm sure that there are guys that are putting in lots of extra work that ends up being the separator. And there are other guys who are just doing what's required of them and nothing more. And that's ultimately what I think as a coach, what you want to try to do is find those guys who are going to come the closest to reaching their potential, whatever that potential is. And if they don't love the game, they're probably not going to get there.
Yeah. Mike, not to name drop, but spending some time with Mike Dunlap at Loyola Marymount. And he said, when he met with John Wooden way, way back when, you know, he said, John Wooden told him, you know, it's God, it's family and basketball. But he said, sometimes in December and January, that gets a little bit fuzzy. And, you know, and I say, you know, if that works for John Wooden, then I guess it'll work for me.
Absolutely. Not a bad role model to look up to and take some wisdom from, for sure. All right, let's hop backwards to you developing as a player. And at what point in your high school career do you start to think that maybe you're going to have an opportunity to play beyond high school? Or when do you start thinking about the fact that you want to play beyond high school? Describe what that process looked like for you.
I think that was part of my high school coach. My high school coach was Cal Hubbard, and they said he was a Hall of Fame Illinois high school coach. And I think he really just kind of came to me, really. I guess maybe I don't know if it was this time or and I say this humbly. Maybe I was just humble and I didn't realize that I would be playing at college until he kind of came to me and said, you know, I think you can do it. And so that's when I think I first started thinking about it. And then you start, you know, the recruiting process, you start getting the calls and that sort of thing. And then it became kind of it wasn't just a dream. You know, and I, you know, from that point, you know, then when looking at the process, you know, I was a big guy. I was not a Division I level player, but I had Division I people that were asking me to walk on and that sort of thing. And I think that became the question for me is, you know, do I want to go do that? And that's a completely different thing than going and playing at a Division III, or do you try to, you know, get a partial and go to a D2? Ultimately, for me, it was an academic choice. I liked the place I was going, and the basketball was really good where I went, Illinois Wesleyan. And so I think I got a good blend of those two things. And but I think that I got some help with that with my high school coach. At that point in my life and being in Central Illinois, AAU really hadn't hit Central Illinois. So my only person to talk to about that was my high school coach.
Do you think without his input and his experience that you might have been more seduced by some of the Division I interest that you got? Was he able to give you a more well-rounded picture of where you were? Or did you kind of come to the realization when you looked at guys that were going Division I versus guys that were playing Division III that were in your area? How did you kind of come to the realization that of the level where you wanted to be? Was it, I know you mentioned that it was strictly, that the academics played a big part in it. But every kid, obviously you're flattered by getting interest from Division I schools. So go back to that moment and talk a little bit about maybe how Coach Hubbard influenced your decision there to end up going to Illinois Wesleyan.
Yeah, he gave me just the information. I don't think he pushed me anyway. I think he just told me the pros and the cons of a lot of different places. I'll be honest. ISU, that was back when Kevin Stallings was at ISU. Illinois Wesleyan is in the same town as Illinois State. And that's where I went to high school. And that was when they had Dan Moeller and Skip Schaefbauer and some really good teams that they made the NCAA tournament. And we would play with them on the weekends. And even when I was in high school, I'd play with them. And I be honest with you, I wasn't good enough. I think that I was humbled enough to see that You know, I could go there, but I'm not going to get on the floor and play. And you know, I think for me, and this is going to be part of the conversation I have with every recruit, you know, whenever they're looking at that D1, that's saying, hey, walk on. You know, there's a big difference between watching the Duke North Carolina game and being the walk on at that bench, and then being at, you know, a Western Illinois or somewhere else where there's not a huge crowd, and you're not going to be playing, and you're going to be practicing and doing everything else. I think that has to be part of the process for a guy. You know, is that really worth it to you? Is that really what you want? And I wanted to play. I wanted to get on the floor. And if I was going to go to practice and lift and do all that kind of stuff, I wanted to get on the floor. And so, you know, and I mean, I felt like I made a great decision. I mean, we had really good teams and won a national championship. And so I played with some really good players. It worked out perfectly for me. You know, I think to each his own. And that's really the truth, you know. And to even take that a step further, sometimes we have recruits that we're talking to that are looking at us and looking at walking on or looking at an NAIA scholarship. And there are times when I'm almost hopeful that they go and they take it, because if they come play for me as a freshman, they might not even get on the floor for me as a freshman, you know, and now I'm going to have to battle all year having to pump them up and stroke their ego. And they're, at, you know, they're thinking I'm at Division III and I'm not playing. If they go and they just get beat down as a walk on somewhere and somebody else is working on them, they kind of get humbled. And when they come play for you, you know, they're a year into that, and they sometimes, you know, I think to myself, well, he wasn't going to play for me that first year anyway. You know, let somebody else do all that work and do all those problems. And when he comes to me, he's going to be ready to play basketball, and he's, I don't have to worry about the ego.
Yeah. I think that a lot of times that kids get humbled fast, and it's interesting that I think there's such a big adjustment from the high school level to the college level in terms of the demands physically, mentally, emotionally, just that transition. And also I think that there's such a lack of understanding among high school players, and especially parents of high school players, especially today, because they've grown up, both the parents and the kids, hearing nonstop about how great their kid is, and everybody has expectations of what they think their kid's going to do and where they think they're going to go. And, you know, I think the younger they are, the more skewed their perspective is. Cause when you're in fifth, sixth, seventh grade, everybody is headed to Duke or North Carolina, and parents all have that thought process that that's kind of where they're going. And then as you get older, they start to kind of realize, but I don't think parents understand, and I don't think players understand how good you have to be to play college basketball at any level. Forget about playing Division I basketball, but just to play, to your point, at the Division III level, at the NAIA level, how good you have to be. And one of the things I wish we could do is I wish we could take the parents of every 10th grade high school player in the country and have them go to a high-level Division III college basketball game, or have them go to a high-level NAIA basketball game and just watch and say, look at the quality of play that's out on the floor, and then compare it to where your child is right now at this moment, and start to ask yourself, wow, are they capable of even getting to that level, let alone to the Division II or Division I level? And I think if we could educate parents about the amount of time and effort and skill that it takes in order to play college basketball, we'd be able to probably give those kids a better basketball experience, because it wouldn't all be about getting that, taking that next step to college basketball scholarship or an opportunity. Instead, it would be about maximizing what they're doing right there in the moment, whether that's their junior high career, that's their, what they're doing in AAU or high school. I think if we could educate parents, I think we'd be a lot better off. Do you see that as a college coach, sort of the unrealistic expectations that not necessarily players have, but parents?
Oh yeah. You know, when a recruit comes on a official visit for us, you know, I ask the question, have you seen a D3 game? And I will tell you 75% of the time it's no, you know.
Yeah, and, I believe that.
And so, you know, that's the first part of that process totally with me, is You know, they'll play with our guys and that, you know, that sort of thing. I think that's eye opening for the kid. You know, if the parents want to stick around and they want to watch their kid play, you know, against our team, I think that gets really eye opening for them too. I think that's that education process for them. The nice thing that we have now is that we didn't have 10, 15 years ago is that, you know, our games are all streamed now, you know, and so it used to be, well, it's really hard to get a kid and to get to a game. And if he's from 4 hours away, it's the season, you know, he just doesn't get there. You know, now they watch your games. And I think that that's helped them realize, you know, this is a pretty high level of basketball. I'll tell you, our league, and I know I'm bragging on our league, but our league and the Wisconsin League, there's some really, really good basketball teams. And, you know, and I think there's a lot of teams in our league that can beat a lot of D2 teams and without the scholarships. And I think that that's something that the parents have to see for themselves, I guess, sometimes.
Yeah, I think sometimes seeing is believing, and it's hard to get that across to people without them experience it firsthand, whether that's in the case of a kid playing with a bunch of Division III players, whether that's the parent actually sitting in the stands and seeing a game or watching it, you know, via the internet. And if they don't do that, and I think it's classic that, you know, you said that 75% of people said, I've never seen a Division III game, and yet here they are taking an official visit to a Division III school. That's, I mean, it's really kind of funny when you stop and think about how critical that decision is in terms of where you're going to play your college basketball, where you're going to go to school, and what that experience is going to be like for you, first of all, in those 4 years, and then what it's going to set you up to be able to do for the rest of your life. And sometimes I get amazed by the, you know, the amount of time and resources and energy that parents put into their children's youth basketball or just in general youth sports experience. And yet when it comes to some of these huge decisions, people put on these blinders and they only see right. one thing, and they don't explore all the options that could potentially present their kid with a much better path, both in terms of basketball and in terms of setting themselves up for future success, instead of, like you described, sending a kid to a place where, even if they were to make the team as a walk-on, how pleasurable is it to spend, you know, practicing 3 hours a day, getting beat up on the scout team, going through all that stuff, and just knowing that you're never going to get on the floor. I can speak to my own playing career. My first year when I played as a freshman, I played very little. Maybe, I don't know, by the end of the season, I might have been getting in 6 or 7 minutes a game. But for the most part, I practiced most of the season and didn't play hardly at all. And that was by far the most difficult season of my career. I couldn't imagine going through and doing all those things that I did for 4 years without ever having, you know, without the possibility of, you know, being able to get on the floor. And so I think there's, the point here is that there's many more paths to having success in basketball than there are just getting a Division I or Division II scholarship. There are lots of different ways that you can maximize your basketball and educational experiences throughout the college basketball landscape. And people, because of what they see on TV, a lot of times parents and kids only have one thought process in mind. And I think that's something that, you know, if we could change that, I think the basketball landscape as a whole would be much better off.
I would agree. You know, the thing that I get is, you know, I think it's, we all know this in our head. Whenever somebody is happy in a lot of areas of their life, they perform in those areas a lot better. You know, when somebody has a good home life and they're not worried about money and their mortgage is getting paid fine and everybody's healthy, you know, I do a really good job at work. I got a free head. I got a free mind, you know, and when something bad happens in one area, it affects those other areas because that's what happens with humans, you know. And I always laugh that for some reason with recruits and parents, they don't realize that those things go together. If a kid's going halfway across the nation to go out in the middle of nowhere to a place that he doesn't really like, do you really think he's going to play good basketball? You know, those things go together. You're going to have to, you know, you're going to have your social life and your academic life and all those things. They're going to have to fit together or else you're not going to reach your potential. And so I'm always really puzzled whenever people are like, well, Coach, why are you even talking about that? Well, because if he leaves his girlfriend, he hasn't been dating for 3 years, is he going to be happy about that? You know, and maybe he is, I don't know, but, but you know, you need to figure that out, because, you know, he's not going to be playing really well if he's unhappy in a lot of the areas of his life. You know, they just don't. And so I think that that happens. That's why you see a lot of these transfers. I think they jump at what looks to be the best thing. And what the best thing is not that, you know, it's the whole picture. And
yeah, the rate of transfer is incredible.
It is. It's trickling down. I mean, it's not just the D1 level. I mean, that's what gets tracked now in the portals and the D2s and the portals, but you still see it at the D3 level now. I mean, it's where it's at. You know, I think it starts, you know, you got kids jumping from high schools and jumping from AU programs. And I think you go to college and if everything isn't fitting right together, then okay, well, I'm going to go find somewhere else and make it work. And so, I think it's just what it is right now. But I think that for me as a coach, I feel like when a parents and a player sitting in my office, I need to tell them that, you know, I need to tell them that you're going to have to be happy in other areas for you to be a good basketball player.
Yeah. I think the culture of basketball suggests that the transfer problem is, as you said, it has trickled down all the way into the amount of kids that are changing high schools or that go somewhere and they're upset because they didn't start on the varsity when they're a freshman or they're not getting enough shots or touches. And I think you see that way, way more than you ever did. I always tell people that I knew who I was going to play with in high school from the time I was in like third grade. I knew who my teammates were going to be in high school because those are the kids you grew up with. You knew them, you played with them all year round. And now it's like, you have no idea where a kid's going to go to school and even if they're going to stay there. And it's got to be, I haven't coached in high school for, I don't know, 11 or 12 years. It's got to be tremendously challenging. You know, some of the high school coaches we've talked about, you know, they've built the type of culture that keeps kids there, but not everyone is fortunate enough to be able to, you know, have an established culture. And if you're a new coach coming into a high school situation, it's got to be tremendously challenging to be able to establish that culture to get kids to stick around, because everybody's looking for that grass being greener on the other side of the fence. And as we all know, a lot of times it's, you know, that's not necessarily the case. It's not every situation is always perfect, but you got to try to find the situation that's best for you.
There's still time to register for the final Head Start basketball camp of the summer at Brunswick Rec Center. We'll also be having our Summer Skills Challenge at the Strongsville Rec Center on July 29th and 30th. You can find out more information or get registered for both of those events at www.headstartbasketball.com.
So I want to jump back to your playing days in college and just give you a chance to share one or two things, because we've been talking about maximizing the experience both from a basketball and just life standpoint. So can you share maybe one or two things that stand out for you as a college basketball player, a couple stories that you remember that kind of encapsulate your experience there at Illinois Wesleyan while you were a player?
Oh, you know, I think it's always like the trips you take. And, you know, I was fortunate, and I say this very humbly, I was a role player on these teams, but, you know, we played in a couple Final Fours and won one and had to really – some really good teams for all my 4 years there. And so I think I have that just in general experience of we played in a good culture and winning program. So I have that good feeling anyway, but the things I remember are just the trips and, you know, going on the beach on the, you know, whenever you're down in Florida, you know, you're, I think that's the kind of stuff I remember. You know, as now I get older, it's funny, I get reminiscent. But yeah, I realize that, you know, whenever, you know, I got married, you know, I've got 15 to 20 guys that come back to my wedding, you know, and I did the same thing for them. And I said, that to me is what I always kind of now look at. It's like, man, my best friends were guys that I played basketball with for, you know, all those years. And I think that that's, that's really, you know, for me, what you really want for, if I had a, you know, I do have a son, I have a 2-year-old. When he gets done playing, I want him to have some good thoughts of, you know, trips and playing, and then have the friends. You know, I can't think of anything really specific that I can say on a podcast that I would say, but we had a good time with my guys, and but those are the things that I remember.
What was the best place you went? What was the best trip you went on?
Well, they went to Hawaii the year before I got there and the year after I left. So obviously I missed
that. You got ripped off. Yeah,
I did get ripped off. You know, playing wise, we went down to Florida some. We went out to Westmont and played in an NAIA tournament out in Santa Barbara. That was a fun trip. You know, when you're from Central Illinois and going out to California, that was a good gig. But we never did to take the foreign trip. That's one thing that I've done now as a coach. We always take a big trip. We just got back from Spain about a month ago with our team. We've been to Greece and Belgium, and I feel like I want to spread that with these guys. You know that's what they're doing. You played. How many games? If I told you, you know, how'd you do sophomore year versus this team, you wouldn't have any clue.
I have no idea.
You don't remember. I can't remember if we beat Wheaton when I was a freshman. You know, I can't remember that stuff. But I remember, you know, going to Orlando and we won the national championship the year before, D3, and Bethel had won the NAI championship, and we played each other in that game, and we actually lost that game by about 5, and the next day we won the third place game, and our coach took the trophy and tossed it in the back of the van and said, anybody want to keep this? And I can tell you this now, but it showed up as a tapper on a keg one time. So that trophy made its way around. But I think that kind of stuff you still remember, you know, 25 years later.
Yeah, it's so true. I think it's funny that, you know, you said about not being able to remember, you know, what happened in this game when I was a sophomore or a junior. People will ask me, you know, I have friends who I went to school with that will ask me, hey, do you remember that game you played against OU when you were a junior? And this happened. I'm like, yeah, I don't remember that. We played OU like 10 times over the course of my 4 years. I'm not sure I remember the specifics of that one particular game. And there are a few, obviously, that stand out. And for me, it's always the losses, I think, that stand out. Yep. more than the wins. The painful losses are the ones that I tend to remember more so than the wins. But yeah, it all kind of runs together. And really what you do remember, what you do take away, are those relationships that you built with your teammates, and also some of just the special things and places that you got to go and experiences that you had, you know, on road trips and just things that are, you know, things that somebody else has in their life, but you got to experience it through basketball with your teammates. And just, we all know the camaraderie that's built within a team, and that creates opportunities to bond in ways that I just don't think are possible in other, you know, in other ways of life. I think the bonds that you build with teammates by going through the things that you have to go through, especially as a college basketball player, I think are, you know, those things are invaluable, and they build the types of friendships that last forever. And you can, you know, you cannot talk to a teammate for years and years and years and see him, and it's easy to fall right back into, hey, do you remember this? Do you remember that? And that's one of the great things about being a player on a team. But it's also, I'm sure, one of the things that you love about a coach is building those kinds of relationships with your players, so that 5 years down the road, 10 years down the road, when those guys come back and they give you a phone call and they say, hey, coach, and they want to tell you about something that's going on in their life, to me, that's one of the most satisfying pieces of being a coach that you can experience, is when you get one of those calls.
That is the most satisfying, and people have asked me what is the best thing, and that's the best. And we like to win and we like the games, but that is the best out of all of them, is when guys pop in. And our pillars, our foundation of our program is humility and just being appreciative of life's opportunities. And I think my guys maybe get sick of me saying it a lot, but I said, you know, guys, we play 25 games at Division III, and then you get conference tournament, whatever. So I said, if you're good, you play 30. that you're going to get, and half of those are going to be at home and half on the road. So you're going to have 60 road trips in your life. So put your phone away and enjoy being with anybody, because in about 4 years, how hard is it for you or me, Mike, to get 15 guys together to go do anything? We can't get four guys to play golf together. I mean, that's a hard enough thing in itself, you know? And so I said, you're not going to get 15 guys to get all on a bus and have the opportunity to go for a day or two and play. So I said, you know, enjoy that opportunity, be appreciative of it, because that's why you came to play college basketball. The other stuff you can do later in life, but it goes away. It's fleeting.
It's totally true. And I think that it's one thing that I think anybody who's been an athlete or been a coach, I think you tend to underestimate how important those moments with your teammates, with your fellow coaches, how much those things are. Like when I stopped coaching in high school, I had coached for, I guess, 13 or 14 years with the same staff. And so I was the varsity assistant. We had the same head varsity coach and the same JV coach.
Wow, that's hard.
It was very hard, very unique situation. And just, you know, all of us got along and everybody understood the role. And it was just a great group. And when I eventually ended up stopping and ending my coaching career, mostly because of just wanting to be from my closer to my family and the commute and all these other things that kind of went into it. But the one thing, surprisingly, what I missed really was not necessarily the basketball. It was not necessarily the games. It wasn't necessarily the practices. What I found that I missed the most was that relationship with those other coaches and just getting done with practice and then sitting in the coach's office for 45 minutes afterward. Those are the conversations and things that I missed more than anything. And I think a lot of times when you talk to people who get out of sports, there's just no way in real life to replace those types of things that, just like you said, with your teammates, with your fellow coaches, you can't replicate that in your day-to-day life, especially as you get older, you get more demands placed on your time and you have a family, it becomes really, really hard. So that's what I really miss about coaching is my fellow coaches. As you were finishing up your college career, did you always know that you wanted to coach, or was that something that hit you once you were done playing? You looked around, you're like, man, I still want to be involved in the game. Maybe I should get into coaching. At what point did you start thinking that coaching was a route you wanted to go for your profession?
It was about my sophomore year of college. I'm actually a math major. I started out because I wasn't sure if I wanted to be an accountant or an actuary or what I wanted to do, but I knew I liked math. So I went that direction. And after that freshman year, I sat with my high school coach again. I was lucky. One of my best friends that played high school basketball with me also played college basketball with me. And that was our coach. It was his dad. So it was kind of a unique bond. And so I got to talk to him a lot. And he just said, you know, he said, I know right now you should be a coach, and I think you want to be a coach. And I, you know, the one thing that it was really good is that my parents are really supportive of that. You know, that was one thing that I don't know why I was worried about that. But, you know, you go to a Division III school, you pay some money to go there, and in your mind you're thinking, oh, mom and dad want me to, I better get a job and go make some money. And I said, I really I want to coach. And they were like, do it. And I can tell you, I was a teacher for a year after I got out of college. I was a high school teacher and coach, sophomore basketball coach. And then I got lucky. I became the head assistant at Elmhurst at the age of 23. I was totally unqualified, but to be honest with you, they were having trouble beating Illinois Wesleyan, and that's where I played. And so they hired me just so they could get the secrets, I think.
Nice.
We won the first time we played him. So I walked in and said, I'm done. I did what you hired me for. I came in at 23, and I remember I was making, you know, as a teacher, I can't remember, it was $40,000 as an entry level teacher. And my mom, I called her, I said, hey, I got it. I got the head assistant's job at Elmhurst, and you know, I'm jacked up. And she's like, oh my goodness, how much more money are you going to make? And I said, well, I'm getting $15,000. No benefits, you know, but there's a guy that has an attic and he's going to rent it out to me for $150 a month. And I think, you know, that was the thing that my mom and dad were like, hey, great, do it, go for it. And so I had a coach that really pushed me that direction. And then I had parents that were supportive of me toiling and not making any money and doing that gig. And I think any young coach probably goes through that. And then it paid off.
That sounds like the glamorous life of a college coach, John.
It does it right there. If you don't get in, you don't get into it, I think, for the money. Sometimes you get paid after a while, but it doesn't happen right away.
Yeah, I think there's that's another one of those public misperceptions is people see all the guys and they, you know, they read about and they hear about the coach making $5 million a year. Even those guys that eventually do get to that level, many of them started out just like you did, making zero or paying somebody to be part of their staff. Yep. And living, you know, four people in a one bedroom apartment, and people don't understand, you know, the amount of sacrifice I think that it takes to you know, to get to the level that you see with these glamorous Division I jobs. And there aren't very many of those out there. More of what college coaching is that guys who just love basketball, guys who love the process of coaching, guys who love the kids and the players that they get to interact with on a day-to-day basis. And anybody who gets in it for the money is soon quickly, you know, set straight that that's not really what reality is going to be. And does it happen for some guys? Sure it does. And, you know, there are obviously success stories in terms of financial, but there's also a lot more success stories of guys who find their niche, who find that they fit best at a particular level with a particular type of kid, with a particular institution. And ultimately, it goes back to what we talked about earlier in the show, which is, you know, you got to be happy in your life. And you got to make sure that you have the proper balance between basketball and family and everything that goes along with that. And when you do, you know, then the coaching process can be extremely, extremely enjoyable. But people don't always see the sacrifices that are made, especially the guys, young guys make early in their career. A lot of people don't understand that process and what coaches go through. So talk a little bit about what that first year was like for you as a college assistant, living in the attic, making $15,000 a year. What was that like for you, both from a life and a basketball standpoint, that first year?
That was a grind, man. And I worked for a coach, Mark Shear, who was really great to me. But he really just kind of said, you're the recruiting coordinator and go do it and figure it out and bring us some players. And, you know, and I'm like, what, how the hell do I do this?
Good luck with that, John.
Yeah. You know, I'm like, okay. You know, and, luckily, we won the league that year. And so then, and we were graduating a lot of guys, so that's enticing to any young guy. And so, we had a really, really good recruiting class, got three All-Staters, and it was a good class. And, that just kind of got the ball rolling for us, to keep it going. But, that was really eye-opening for me. I never knew all the stuff that coaches did. I mean, you know this, but I felt like as a player, I always felt like the coaches came down for practice and then I was like, what do they do all day?
Right.
And you know, they must just sit up there, draw plays, you know? And it was really just mind blowing to me, the organization of everything. And, but it was really great for me because I will say this for Mark, he really helped me in my career, because I was an assistant for him with him for a long time, is that every year he kind of gave me more and more responsibility, and to the point where there were things that I just did that were mine. And that was great for me because, you know, Pat Riley always says, don't underestimate your time in the trenches. And as an assistant, that's the best time in the world. None of these wins and losses go on your record. You know, you just work. And you get to see things that you like and don't like, and you can keep track of them in your head and journal them. And so when I become a head coach, and so it was great for me to see all that and put it all together. I played for an awesome college coach. He won Denny Bridges. He won almost, you know, over 700 games. He was awesome. But we never had scouting reports. We didn't do, he was an older guy in his 60s. We didn't really have a lifting program. You know, we were a bunch of really good players that played well together, and he coached us well, but we didn't do a lot of the things that a lot of programs do. And so that just freaked me out. But I got to learn a lot. I, I took it all in, and I worked a lot of camps. And we were talking a little bit off the air about what are you pushing for your assistants, you know, or if you put yourself in their shoes again. I really do a lot of, you sit down with me and I want to mentor you into becoming a head coach. You know, what are you seeing? What do you like? What don't you like? What would you do differently? You know, that sort of thing. Where do you have goals for yourself for this year? You know, what are you doing that you're not doing right now? And I've been lucky. I've had some assistants that are now head coaches, and I'm proud of that, because I feel like I've taken that part of my life where I was like, I got thrown in as 23 and I was totally blitzed. And now I'm saying, okay, I'm going to slow this down for you and help you out, and so that you understand what's happening here, and you're building yourself up to become a head coach. And I think that that's been part of my process as a head coach, is helping those people.
Yeah, I think that's sometimes something that may get discounted, is the responsibility that you have as a head coach to not only develop your players, but also to develop your coaches, especially when you have young guys who are new to the profession.
Right.
That's sometimes something that gets lost, is that, you know, as a head coach, it's easy, I think, to get caught up in the wins and losses, to get caught up in the things that are important to you and your program as a head coach, and kind of forget about the things that are important as an assistant coach. And I'm sure for you, the fact that you spent the number of years that you did as an assistant helped you to understand not just what a good assistant does and should do, but also what you would like to see from your head coach to help you develop as an assistant. I want to jump back to something you said in your last little paragraph there, and that was when you talked about how your team, when you were playing, that you didn't have scouting reports, you didn't have a weight program. And this is one of the things that I find to be very interesting. And when I look back at when I was playing or when I was coaching, I think one of the things that when you're on a team or when you're on a coaching staff, there's always a part of you that wonders how other teams do things. Yeah. And I know when I was playing as a player, I would always look and wonder, you know, because again, when you're playing college basketball, there's always things that in your mind as a player just seem crazy. And you're like, yeah, why are we doing this? And what, yeah, you know, like, not everybody can be doing this stupid thing that we're doing. Why are we doing it? I wonder if school X is doing that too. And one of the things that I always wish that I could have done as a player is just go and observe a practice of, you know, these teams that we played against, and just kind of see what their coaching staff was like and how they did things and compare. And so I know that as a coach now, like, how often do you get out and go watch other teams practice? Like, do you get a chance to go and watch, you know, some of the Division III schools by, or Division I schools by you practice? Do you get a chance to go to a Bulls practice and see what they do? Is that something that you get an opportunity to do?
I wish we had more time to do it. I really do. I think whenever you talk about us, we're, you know, with practicing and then with recruiting, we're at least out two nights a week, usually three, and we have games twice a week, and you've got all the film and everything you go. And if you have a family like I do, you know, I think you miss out on a lot of that. I think, you know, I work in like Jay Billis camp in the summer. Last year I flew out to Los Angeles and watched in August whenever Loyola Marymount was going to Australia. Mike had me out for 3 days just so I could watch practice that. So there's times when you can get into that, but I think during the season it gets really hard to do that. I think it really becomes a lot of, okay, I'm going to go sit down with you and do that. I think that one of the things that, like, Don Showalter always says, and it's really true, it's not what you teach, it's how you teach it. And I think that that's the hardest thing whenever you don't go around and see other people and talk to other people, is that there's YouTube videos and there's championship videos and all the stuff you can watch, and there's a million things to do. And I think as a young coach, I push that on my assistants. I'm like, guys, we can do a million of this stuff, but how are we teaching it? You know, how are we going to get this right? And I think that that's where you have to go talk to other coaches, and you have to go see their practices or go see them work out a guy, because how they teach it is that's the difference between the good ones and the average ones.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think the way that you go about teaching and instructing the skill or putting in an offense or a defensive system, you know, it's easy to say, all right, we're going to be a pack line team, or we're going to run, you know, we're going to run the dribble drive or whatever. But if you don't know how to teach that, then it becomes very, very difficult to do it well, obviously. So you have to look at all the different methods that coaches have used and try to tap into people's expertise to be able to become better at your craft so that you can, you know, improve your own team, help your players to get better and improve. So I want to ask you this question related to that. And if you think back to that first year when you started and go to where you are now, what's something that you have learned? What's something that you have gotten tremendously better at from that first year when you were coaching to where you are now? And I'm sure you could say 25 things.
Yes, but, there's a lot.
But if you could pick out one or two things that maybe you didn't realize about coaching, how important it was, but just maybe one or two things that really stand out for you that over the course of your career, you've come to understand on a much deeper level than you did when you were 23.
Well, you know, I will tell you, first things first, I've become a much better teacher on the court. And I would every coach kind of labels themselves or people label them. And I would say I'm a relationship coach. I think I get along with my players really well. I push them, but we have good relationships. And that's always been my number one thing. And still is. It really is how to communicate with people. But there was a time in my career, even as a head coach, that I look back now and I wasn't doing enough teaching on the court. I was keeping guys playing hard and I was keeping them motivated and they were playing together and we had good team, but I wasn't giving them the edge. And I think that I've become a much better teacher. I've slowed things down. I still go pretty quick, but I've slowed down, so that I've become better. I think the other part that, I had, and I never realized this, is sometimes guys remember things that you can't believe they remember. We had an All-American named Brent Rook, big 6'9" guy, and I was the lead recruiter on him. I was an assistant, and we got him, and he played for us for 4 years, and we had good teams and all this other stuff. And he came into my office a year after he graduated. And he goes, "Coach, I remembered something today. I had an interview over at Chase Bank, and I remembered something you always told me." And I was like, you know, I'm all pumped up. I'm like, you know, all these jokes I'm dropping on you and all this stuff. And he says, you know, I had my slacks on, and he goes, my socks at this time, now they change them up. But he goes, you know, my socks didn't match my pants. He goes, I remember you always said it's all about the details and your socks need to match. And so he goes, I stopped at Kohl's right before I went to my interview, and I did it. And he goes, then I was so happy with my socks, even like crossed my legs like you do so that he could see my socks and all that stuff. And I was like, after 5 years of playing for recruiting and playing and all the things that I think that I brought to you, buying socks at it for an interview was what he took. And I look back on that now, and it's like, guys remember some of the most weird stuff that you tell them. And so that whenever you say things, what comes out of your mouth has to be sincere, and those guys have to understand that there are guys paying attention to what you're saying, even if they don't think, you might not think they are if they respect you. And that's something I never really grasped when I was 25 or 30. I think at the age of 43, I pick my words better, and I try to be smarter. I actually think about what I'm going to say at practice and anticipate the problems, and then what am I going to say then? Because I don't think I would have done that when I was 25 or 30. Now I think I actually think about those things. They even write them on my practice plan. Hey, when they screw this thing up, don't bring this up. You know, that sort of thing.
That's an awesome story. I think it's so true. I'm sure if you went and polled every single coach around the country, they would probably all have some kind of similar story of a player who came to them with something that was totally out of left field that they have no recollection of probably ever saying to the kid. And yet, to your point, that everything that you say can be remembered by somebody. And so what I took from what you just said was that you're far more intentional in the way you communicate with your players today than you were probably Definitely. When you started, where before it was like, all right, I'm coming into practice and here's what we're going to do. And, but you're not necessarily thinking through what you're going to say. Whereas now you're much more intentional about looking for, anticipating the problems, knowing what you're going to do to correct and fix those problems. And because you have so much more experience, you probably have a pretty good idea of what's going to be screwed up before it gets screwed up.
Right.
And that allows you, and that allows you to prepare and give your players your best. And I think being intentional in everything you do makes you so much more effective as a coach. And I know I can speak to that for myself. There are times where if I'm intentional about what I'm trying to teach or intentional about a life lesson or something along the lines of character or leadership that I want to make sure I touch on, if I'm intentional about building that into my practice, then I can be pretty sure that I'm going to be effective with that. If mm-hmm. it's not something that I've built into and thought about beforehand, then it's very easy for that stuff to get lost and not get conveyed to the players. And so I think being intentional is a great lesson for any coach to be able to take away from what you just said, because when you are intentional, you're much more likely to accomplish what it is that you're setting out to accomplish, as opposed to just kind of flying off the cuff. And you tend not to be as effective when you're doing things that way.
Right. You know, Alan Stein is really good at this. He says, you know, when you're designing your preseason workouts or whatever it is, you think of the end and then work your way backwards, you know, and then, you know, what do you want to see? And I tell that if there's ever a young assistant or something and they're asking me about how to practice and anything, I said, okay, at the end of practice, what are the two things I want to say to the team that if we've had a good practice, what am I going to be saying? And so let's work backwards from that. So how am I going to build a practice to get to those two things? Because you can't get to everything. And I think that's, like you said, that becomes intentional in everything you do there. And sometimes it's harder stuff. It's like, hey, I want to build some adversity into practice because our guys aren't talking enough on the court, you know? Okay, we're going to build this in. They're going to crack. Okay, so coaches, what's going to happen when they crack? Who's going to take over? What are we going to say? Who are we going to talk to about it? You know, it's like, those are the things that don't, that's, again, we all know what to teach. I can do this drill, but how you teach it, how do I get that adversity in that drill, and how do I respond to it, and who do I talk to, and what do I have the coaches say to these guys? And I think that's the key to everything.
So there's some of the things that you were talking about when you mentioned, what do the coaches do all day? there's an example right there of what coaches are doing all day that players have no idea that those conversations are taking place between you and your coaching staff. I mean, we can almost guarantee that no player is thinking that that type of planning is going on when it comes to putting together a practice plan. They're thinking, all right, coach has got us doing drill X, Y, and Z, but they're not putting in, you know, once they come up with that drill, it takes 5 seconds to write it down on the practice plan and they're done. Whereas obviously you're going in depth into what's going to potentially go well, what's potentially going to be the trouble, how are we going to handle it when these different issues arise, and players have no idea that all that stuff's going on behind the scenes.
No. And there's labor and then there's invisible labor. And I think when you ask about young coaches and as you develop and become a better coach, and I'm still developing, I know that I am an older guy, but I still feel like I'm a young coach, that I'm still learning a lot of things. And I feel like every year my invisible labor goes up a lot more than my visible. And just because I think I'm thinking about a lot more things and trying to teach it better.
All right. So let's jump back on that and talk about when you went from an assistant and you got your first head coaching opportunity. Talk a little bit about what that transition was like and what the learning curve was from going from being an assistant to all of a sudden now you are the guy who's responsible. It is your one loss record. It is you being the face of the program. Talk about what it was like when you got a chance to take over your own program.
You know, that was, I felt like I was ready. I was an assistant for 10 years. So I felt like I was ready as ready could be. And I had a plan for how I wanted to do things. I think I had a vision and I had things I wanted to see and put together. You know, I knew I was going to make some mistakes and I did plenty. But you know, I think the biggest thing for me was, I think when guys take over programs, whether they're struggling or not, I hate that term whenever guys say, I'm going to get my guys in there. And I said, you know, that term for me is never, I never understand it. I get it. You want to get your guys that you've recruited and there, but you get hired to coach those guys. They don't hire you to coach and then you go get players. You know, there's players on that team and you coach them and you do the best job you can. You know, maybe they're not good enough and maybe you do have to go recruit, but you have to serve them and you have to put in an effort for them. And I was lucky. I took over at St. Francis, which is an NAIA school. They'd struggled the year before. There was some talent, but they were 8-22 or 8-21. And, that first year we flipped it. We went 21-10. And I brought in a couple of players, but it really was just getting the buy-in from the players that were there. And I think that basically what I just told you is what I told them. I'm not trying to run you guys off. I'm trying to get you guys good. And if you don't want to work, and then maybe I'll have to run you off. But if you want to work and you're good, then I think you're going to like this. And I think that worked for me. I like I said, I made plenty of mistakes, but I felt like that was my biggest thing. I guess I would give to anybody taking over that new program is, Don't just toss people away. They're people, you know. Try to help them. That's what they wanted, you know. And if they're talented, they really want it.
Well, that's relationships, right? I mean, that's what you've been talking about the whole time. Is as a relationship coach, you're going to come into a program where you already have kids that are part of the team and have been part of that previous regime, and your job as a coach there is to build those relationships. And when you build those relationships, now that allows you to build and put your team together and have the type of success that you were able to have in that very first year. What, when you took over,
yep,
what was the very first thing that you looked at and you said, okay, I have to do this in order for this program to get where I want it to go? What was the number one thing, the number one priority that you had as you stepped into that head coaching chair?
Call the players and ask them what's going on. And I mean that, and I've done that at both places I've taken over as a head coach. And I'm not saying tell me all the bad stuff. Tell me the good stuff too. But the very first thing you should be doing when you get a job is you should be picking up the phone. You might not start for 2 months, but you say, hey, listen, I'm taking over. I'm thinking about what we're going on. And before I take down any fences, I need to know why they were put up. And, what's been going on, you know, tell me what you want to see and then get that input from them. In terms of, I mean, you still have to be in charge, but just the input in terms of, what would you like to see? What would you like to see for yourself? Okay. And I think that was the biggest thing, because that's the first step in the relationship building is, you know, you get input and you start to figure guys out. But it also tells you the direction you go with them. You know, I knew I wanted a tough, hardworking team. I wanted to get the ball moving because I felt like I watched film and the ball was stopping too much. I had those ideas already, and that was going to happen. So that was going to be my stamp on that team. But the other stuff, the negotiable stuff, I wanted to figure out with them, you know, and I figured out some things. And I want to take another step back a little bit too. One thing I hate when coaches take over, don't throw the other coach under the bus. I hate that we change the culture. Even if the culture wasn't all that good, don't do that to that coach. Actually, you know what? I had a great relationship. I still have a great relationship with the coach that was there before me because I didn't stomp all over him. I actually called him up and I said, hey, can I pick your brain? You know, if you don't want to talk to me, don't talk to me. But, you know, this, I just want to hear what's going on, what your thoughts on guys are and that sort of thing. And that started a whole relationship up with that coach that helped me. I got so much background even before I got to that team that helped me. And so I think you have to get a lay of the land, and you have to pick up the phone or have people or go eat lunch and go do those types of things so you know what you're doing. And then when you pick it, just have some conviction and start doing it.
To be able to reach out to the former coach, I'm sure that not everybody who gets a job does that. And to your point, we've all seen and heard that term of, hey, we needed to change the culture, which we can interpret that in a number of ways. But I think the main way it would be interpreted is, hey, the guy before me wasn't running the ship the way it should have been right. run. And I'm going to come in here and wave my magic wand and get everything fixed. And anybody who's been a coach for a long time knows that magic wand doesn't exist. There are certainly things that you could do as a coach, and you have your systems in place that you believe in that are going to help you to establish the type of culture that you want to have in your program. But I think you make a great point in that there's no reason to trash another coach on their way out the door in order to make yourself look good. And that doesn't mean that you can't make changes. That doesn't mean that you're not going to put your stamp on the program, but it does mean that, you know, it's just like in life, the way you would teach your players or you teach your own kids as a parent, that you don't need to put someone else down in order to lift yourself up. And I think that's a great lesson to be learned through that story that you just told.
Yeah, I appreciate it. That's important to me. I think that I think in both times of taking over, I think the thing that I always see is that there's a thirst with the players to do something different or improve. And so I had an interesting one. When I took over at Elmhurst, I was an assistant for 10 years. We'd had a really good run there and been a top 10 team. Then I left to go to St. Francis, and things had kind of fallen off at Elmhurst. And it was funny because the coach I took over for was the coach I worked for. And so I have a very good relationship with him. You know, I had the assistant that was there. And when I came in, he was a former player that I'd recruited. So I kept him on staff. And I said, I want you to take everything that you're doing, all the terminology, every drill, everything like that, and I want you to do what I'm doing at St. Francis. And there's a lot of likeness because, you know, we were doing a lot of the same things.
Right.
And I said, everything that is the same, I want you to highlight. And so he highlighted, and he went through our whole book. And I said, okay, I'm not going to change everything. I'm not going to change how we coach everything. I said, but we're going to rename everything. And it was harder for me than it was for the players, because for 15 years, I've been calling a cross screen, down screen, Raiders action. Well, we called it Chief action, just made total names up and changed everything. And that was like, for me, that was, I don't want to trash the old coach, you know, especially somebody I'd worked for and I knew, but I also knew that I needed to change some things, and I needed the players to know that there was a change. And so that was my way. And it was funny. It was probably like February when the guys were like, coach, you know, did you just rename all this stuff? You know, and I'm like, yeah, we did just rename all this stuff. That was another one where we took over a team that had won, I think, 6 games. They were 6-19, and we flipped it to 14-11 that first year, just with the same players, just changing things and giving them a different direction.
So I know relationships from our conversation are really, really important to you. So as a head coach, what are some things that you do day to day, week to week, season to season, to help build the relationship, A, between yourself and your players, but also to foster the relationship from player to player to make sure that your team has the type of camaraderie that's going to allow you to coach them hard and to be able to have the success that you want to have there?
Sure. That's a question I could go on for about a half an hour. I mean, we do a lot of team stuff. I think every month, I mean, we play volleyball on the beach. We play an annual softball game. I have them over for barbecues. You know, sometimes we just have if there's a guy, you know, 4 guys live in a, you know, older guys live in a house, we say, hey, why don't you come over and we'll throw the laundry in for you if you want to watch TV, you know, that sort of thing. Just, I think there's a lot of those things that you get. I think there's some other things that you can do. I have a rule at lunch. We don't talk about basketball. So if I walk over to the cafeteria and I got a group of guys sitting at the table, we don't talk about our basketball team. You know, I want to know about your girlfriend or your classes, or you can ask me about what's going on. I think that helps on the court. I think one thing I've talked to our coaches a lot about, and I do this a lot, you know, we recruit these guys. Think about all the time that we take to recruit them. We call them, we text them, we write them notes, we go see all these games, all this stuff. And then they come play for us. And then what do we do? We just meet them at practice. And I said, you know, I write recruiting notes to our players. You know, I'll not when they've had a good game, I mean, or a bad game. Sometimes I'm just like, hey, Mike, you know, see that you're really talking a lot at practice and I really appreciate you buying in, and hey, keep it up. And I just stick that in their locker, you know, or some, you know, and I think that part of the process is lost sometimes, because you get them and then, okay, recruiting's over and he's one of our players now. I think you're always trying to still keep doing that. And I think there's just a long list of those things that I think I'm always trying to do. Because then I think whenever something happens on the court and there's hard, then they know that I'm not just bitching at them. It's I care about them and I have a relationship with them. Now I'm trying to teach them, okay, I'll listen to this guy.
Yeah, I think that the day-to-day little stuff and just getting to know your players as more than just basketball players and letting them know that you have an interest in their life outside of the game goes a long way towards giving you the freedom then to be able to coach them in such a way that you can push them to reach their potential. Going back to what right. We talked about way back at the beginning of the podcast, that, you know, the kids who love the game, the kids who've built a relationship with you as a coach, the kids who have bought into the relationships on the team and all that allows you to really coach them and allow them to get to the level of success that all of you are hoping to get to. And when you have a close-knit team, when the coaching staff and the players get along, I think that goes a long way towards winning. And that wasn't always the case. You go Nope. back 15, 20, 25 years, and the style of coaching that we've been talking about here on this entire show wasn't very prevalent. There might have been a few guys doing that, but for the most part, it was a much more of a transactional type relationship between coaches and players. And I think that the relationship piece of it is something that today's players, maybe, I don't know if they take it for granted or not, but I know when I see it, I don't take it for granted, because I know it's something that I would have liked to have been a part of more than, you know, the way that I was coached. Right. Where it was just more of that old school type mentality. So to be able to be in a program like what you just described, where, you know, the coach is obviously investing in not just you as the basketball player, but you as the person and the basketball player, has got to go a long way towards allowing you to, A, have success on the court, but also just what you talked about was your life. You know, when things are good with your basketball, then things can trickle over. That can trickle over into other areas of your life. And when you have those good relationships, it just makes things better all the way around. I want to ask you about incorporating life lessons and trying to teach your guys about things more than basketball, and relate it back to what we talked about a minute ago, which is intentionality. And how much intentionality do you have as you're putting together, let's say, a practice plan, or you're thinking about the totality of your season? How much time and intentionality do you put into figuring out what are some of the life lessons and key things about character and leadership that I want to teach our players? How much time do you put into those kinds of things?
A lot, a ton of time. I mean, well, and you know, I'm not new with this. I mean, Brad Stevens had the Butler way, and there's a lot of ways and culture, and everybody has a different way of saying it. We have our Blue Jay way, and it's a big poster, and it's humility and selflessness and enthusiasm and solidarity. And we have that up on our big board, and all the guys have it. And so I start with that, you know, and I think that's the character building part of building guys and teams. And I think I'm not new with that. I think a lot of coaches do that. I think what I make a point of doing is not forgetting about it and bringing it up a lot. I quiz them on it. I will talk about just stuff, and I'll say, how does this relate to our Blue Jay way? And I think I go back to that. I think the other thing, I think if I was to talk to young coaches, and maybe this is just my personality, I don't know, but I think guys need to latch on to something so that they remember it instead of just old guy giving them another life lesson. You know, guys, this is another life lesson. Case in point, I had a team 4 years ago, really good team. We got up to 2 in the nation. They were good, but they're a bunch of seniors, and it was about January, 9 seniors. And they were, they weren't tuning me out, but they weren't paying attention to me like they normally do, is what I'd say. And so, I brought my daughter, who at the time was like 1 year old, and, we had a bottle, and she was kind of, you know, on the floor. And I said, you know, I used to think that being a parent was giving my daughter the bottle when she was hungry, because she's screaming. I give her the bottle. She's happy. I'm happy. Great parenting. And I said, you know, the problem is that all she'll do is keep crying until she gets a bottle. I need to teach her how to walk and go get her own bottle. So I'm going to not give it to her. And then I'm going to teach her how to get to it. And then that's going to get, she's going to be a better person. That's being a good parent. And I said, I flipped that to a coach. And so I brought my daughter, and she's crawling on the floor trying to get a bottle, screaming. And I think things like that, they trigger in the players. You know, even, you know, 2 years later, the guys are sitting there going, hey, coach, that's like when your daughter had that bottle. You know, and so I think you need to always put, whether it's, you know, sometimes I do corny stuff, but, you know, whether it's corny or whatever it is, they need to latch on to that in their brain. It needs to be memorable or emotional. You know, that has to be something. And then I think that then it resonates, and then that's really does become a life lesson. And instead of you just giving a quote and saying, oh, hey, here's a good quote.
Yes, I would agree with you there 100% that when you're just pontificating, for lack of a better word, that a lot of times they will tune you out. They will say, oh, here comes another, you know, I got to listen to another John Wooden quote. I've had enough of that guy. You know, right. he hasn't been around for 40 years. And, you know, when you can bring something fresh to the table, something that's quick, something that's memorable, I think two things that came to mind as you were talking there. One is, over time, I think I've learned that when you're coaching, it's important to talk very, very quickly, and not quickly in terms of I want to talk really fast, but in terms of I have to make my point quickly and then move on and get the action flowing again. If I stop and give a 2.5 minute speech about something in the middle of practice, after 15 seconds, I've lost everybody anyway. So to be able to talk in very short bursts. And then the other thing that I love that you said, and I probably fall victim to this, if I said there was one shortcoming, that my most glaring shortcoming as a coach even today, is you said that I have to make sure that I don't forget to bring those things up. And I'm a classic guy where I'll hear something new and I'll be all excited about it for a week, and I'll bring it up and we'll be doing this and we'll be making sure that we do that. And I'm all, you know, and then a week later I'm on to the next exciting thing, and I forget about that one thing that, you know, I'm like, I should have just kept going with this because it was really working. It was going well. But I'm always kind of chasing that next thing. And it's important, I think, as a coach, to make sure that you don't forget the things that are your core tenets or your things that you want to make sure that are a part of every single day what you're doing. And whether that's something basketball related, whether it's a life lesson, whether it's just something about building relationships, you have to continue to be intentional about it all the time. And I find for myself that when I'm not intentional, that I do tend to forget, and then something that could have worked really well for me kind of goes by the wayside because I've moved on to something else, and I have to really find myself going back and making sure that I don't forget things that I want to be doing, because I tend to get caught up in the moment or into the next thing. And that's something that I think that's great advice for coaches.
I can tell you, I'm not perfect. I can do that a lot myself. I would say, you know, one of the things we do at the beginning of the year with my coaching staff, we have our, you know, coaches powwow, whatever. And we actually do it with the coaches, and I do it with the players in a little different way. But, you know, I write down, I say, name 10 things that we want to be good at this year. And they all write them on little note cards, and they all have them in front of them. And I don't even look at them, and I write my own. I said, okay, now take away 4 of them. Okay. And then after they do that, that's hard, you know, it's okay. But then I said, okay, now take away 2 of them. Okay. Now take away another 2. Okay. And what do we have left? That's what we need to do. And I said, and that doesn't mean that all this other stuff isn't important. It's just that you can only focus on so much stuff and be really good at it. And so let's make sure we're doing that. And I'll do that with the players too. In a kind of our academic meetings where I'll say, name 10 things you want people to think about you, you know, and, or what's it, or 10 things that are important to you, you know, in your life. And we take away 4 and we take away 3, and you do that and you say, okay, here's the 4 things that are really important to you. And doesn't mean that your friends aren't important to you, but they're probably 6 or 7 in your list. And so that helps, I feel like, keep the intentionality. And what I'll tell the coaches is, okay, we had those 4 or 5 things that we're going to do well. We've now decided in January, there's something else that popped up. It's more important. Okay, what are we taking away? What are we going to replace to put in there? And it's the same thing in our lives. You know, when I was 20 years old, I didn't have kids. My family and kids was not on my list, but it's now on my list, and I've just replaced it. And so you can change those things, but you have to be intentional with how you're changing them.
So if you think back to when you first started coaching, I got to believe that that's something that you become much, much better at in terms of focusing your attention in on 1 or 2 things. Because I know, again, I'm speaking for myself here, but I think it affects lots of coaches, is we tend to, as I'm watching the game, and I've told this story before on the podcast, but my first year of coaching, I coached a JV basketball team and had just finished my playing career and came out, and the first 5 minutes of practice was just me and 12 kids. And I remember watching them play 5-on-5 against each other for 5 minutes and just being like, oh my God, there was like 5,000 things that I want to fix that 5 minutes. And I remember the whole season me saying to myself, I just don't know how to do this with one set of eyes. How do I fix all these different things? And over the course of time, you come to figure out that I can't fix all 5,000 things. I can only fix, to your point, 1, 2 of those things. And those are what I have to focus on. And then once I get those fixed, now I can maybe move on and add something else when I've got these other things under control. And that's something that I'm sure young coaches everywhere struggle with, that is the ability to narrow down your focus.
Oh yeah. And I think that's part of becoming a more seasoned coach, is it's not always sometimes what you teach, it's what you ignore. What are you going to ignore? And that's hard. You know, that's, I always laugh. I said, I sometimes, that's when I get embarrassed, when people, we run open practices. I have people come in a lot. And I said, I always want to laugh, go run over to them, and I want to see if they wrote down in their notes, why the hell is he letting them do this? You know? And I'm like, you know, I just want to go over there and be like, hey, listen, we're trying to do other stuff, and that's just something that's not the priority right now. And, but yeah, I think that's a struggle for everything. I was with you. When I was a young coach, you know, I was that guy that I had 50 plays written. We were going to run all 50, you know, it was going to be, we're just going to run them all. And then I was like, you know, there's only 60 plays in the game. I don't know if I really need 50, you know? And, you know, then, you know, you start narrowing that down and you realize you don't need that much stuff. You just need to be good at some stuff. But I get it.
You find your strengths, and when you find your strengths and you start playing to those, and you know, you can try to minimize your weaknesses, but if you find a couple key things that you can help your team to be really, really good at, that tends to be what leads to success. John, we're coming up on almost an hour and a half. It's been the fastest, I think, hour and a half that
been great.
That we've had. It's been a lot of fun talking to you. I want to give you a chance before we wrap up here to share your contact information so that people can reach out to you. People who have listened to the show, maybe they just want to touch base to you, ask you a question. And then if there's anything that we didn't hit on that you want to share as kind of your parting shot, you can do that as well. And then we'll wrap up the episode.
No, I really appreciate all the time. And I love what you're doing here. I think that this is It's so awesome. I wish, you know, you talk about going back in time. I wish 20 years ago we had, you know, we had a Hoopheads podcast. We had Jay Billis Camp. We had young coaches, rising coaches stuff. You know, all this stuff, I think, for young guys, I mean, you better drink this stuff in, because we never had this. And this is awesome. You know, you couldn't, if you wanted to do a clinic, you had to go somewhere or you had to buy some $40 VHS tape and wait for it to come in. And you don't have that anymore. And so I love what you're doing here. And I think it's awesome for anybody, and not just young guys. I mean, it, for all of us that are learning the game. My contact information, email is John, J-O-H-N, .Baines, B-A-I-N-E-S, at elmhurst.edu. I'm on Twitter at John Baines, at John Baines, and also on Skype and on Instagram and on Snapchat and all the other things that you need to be on for high school kids. So, but usually Twitter and email and texting. If you want to give me a call, my number is 630-244-3109. And I'm not just saying this. I love just meeting some new people. Sometimes I don't have time for a big thing, but sometimes people call me and say, "Hey, coach, I'm in town. Do you mind grabbing lunch or a coffee?" And I think my goal with that is to help somebody out. And then I always leave that with something new in my head. So it always helps me too. So please reach out.
That's awesome. John, we can't thank you enough for spending an hour and a half of your time with us tonight. It was a pleasure getting a chance to connect with you in person down at the Billis camp. And we can't thank you enough for carving some time out of your schedule to jump on the podcast with us. And to everyone out there, we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks. Head Start Basketball's Player Development Academy offers Cleveland area players a unique opportunity to improve their basketball skills. Regardless of a player's age, skill level, or position, training with Head Start Basketball will elevate your game to the next level. Do you want to improve your ball handling, become a better shooter, or develop into a more skilled, confident player? Our academy classes offer training that's designed to do just that. Our training sessions are innovative and will have you learning skills that are transferable to actual games. We have four different class skill levels for boys and girls, ages 4 and up. All Player Development Academy classes will be held at the Strongsville Recreation Center. For more information or to get registered, please visit www.headstartbasketball.com.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.